You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. And embracing the world now, we're going to the USA, where Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter joins us. Tom, welcome to Sunday night once again.
Always good to have the conversation with you.
Pope's been to Africa, and there's been a fair amount of coverage on this. Are there any significant issues which emerge for you out of this trip?
Well, I think first, his attention to Africa is noted because of the explosion of Catholicism on that continent. Our correspondent, John Allen, who went to Africa with the Pope, pointed out that he avoided what John calls the C word, the whole condom debate. And this, he was able to talk about AIDS and talk about justice, but he didn't get roiled in one of those sideshows over what exactly he meant about condoms and are they allowed and aren't they allowed.
Yes, it's interesting that he didn't mention it. The omission has caught people's attention because previously the church has been going into those situations and being very explicit on this. And the fact of omission is as much an interest as one of commission.
Yes, and I think this is just avoiding the whole thing because you can't explain it in a soundbite, and who wants to get into that anyway? I think that, you know, we all know, too, that there are Catholic bishops in Africa who will argue on all sides of that issue and agencies that will do what needs to be done when they're out in the field. The thing that impressed me was, again, the strong language, which I would also link to a release of the document on international finance and economics by Papal Commission on Justice and Peace. But the strong justice language in Benedict's speeches, he really calls on the rest of the world to take a look at what the rest of the world is doing, especially the developed world. This is not an easy message for Catholics, especially conservative Catholics in places like the United States, to listen to and to take in and take seriously.
What's the reception been like? I mean, even in Australia here, we're aware of conservative Catholic intellectuals like Michael Novak and George Weigel. What's their response been to that?
To that document?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been very, very negative. And George Weigel, who's a leading Catholic conservative intellectual, was dashing off pieces on websites and doing interviews, saying, just dismissing it as inconsequential and not coming from a significant office in the Vatican, didn't have the point of view of the Pope and all that sort of thing. Well, I think, first of all, that there aren't any really large offices in the Vatican. And secondly, it is called the Papal Commission. So I don't know why you wouldn't take at least some of the arguments seriously. But I think the really impressive thing is that a lot of people got caught up in the particulars, and understandably, in calling for a world organization and a sort of global watchdog on finances. But I did a reading of the document and counted the term common good was used 22 times in 11 pages. And that phrase has been scrubbed from political conversation in the United States. It was just bracing to see the framework out of which this document arose. Take away those particulars, but if you use the framework and the language that the Vatican office was using to frame this argument, no matter what you were talking about, you're going to come to a fairly radical conclusion for northern tier developed country Catholics.
The other interesting thing about the document was the way in which it chose to ground itself in historic papal teaching and Catholic social justice teaching. It not only grounds itself back in as far as Rerum Novarum and that tradition goes, but it also felt it important to quote every post-war pope almost, though it quoted John the 23rd, it quoted John Paul the 2nd, it even quoted Benedict the 16th, so it was Paul the 6th. So it was trying to ground itself very firmly in authoritative Catholic teaching.
Well, that's precisely it, and that's another argument you would bring up, I think, in the face of the criticism from conservative Catholics and say, which of those threads do you pull? I mean, where do you begin dismissing, and which pope do you throw out? It's a pretty consistent thread, and it's a pretty consistent line of logic and reasoning and a pretty consistent view of how to approach the world as a Catholic community. But I think it's a very interesting approach, and I don't think we're hearing the last of it.
And it was also interesting that it was taken up by the Archbishop of Canterbury when addressing the question of the Occupy movement and St. Paul's Cathedral in London. He pointed to the Pope's document, particularly the call for a global financial authority and for a financial institutions duty, the so-called Robin Hood tax, as things which should need to be looked at.
Right, and I think this document is a Vatican document that, you know, they usually get buried in a little while, found some legs because of the Occupy movement. I mean, not often that people in the street will refer to a papal pronouncement or a Vatican pronouncement, but this got some play in unusual places here.
And may continue to do so. Let's continue with politics in the United States and the way in which religious issues are intruding into the Republican primary contest. It's interesting to note that most of the candidates seem to have to, on the religious arena, play to the very, very conservative, what would be called fundamentalist side of American religion in putting forward their addresses to the Republican faithful. It's almost locked into a seven-day creationism position for most of them.
Yes, this is a very, very strange period in American political history, John. And I think, an awful lot of mainstream, traditional conservative Republicans, fiscal conservatives, you might call them, are in dismay over this. And there's this, there's a very obvious split. You have this strange primary process in this country where it's driven by, the party's base, especially the party out of power. And you get these weird distortions so that a place like Iowa, which is going to have, the first primary, and it's not even a vote, it's these caucuses, they're driven by very conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical Christians, are shaping this in a way that's rather strange. And you have guys and women taking pledges. You have Michelle Bachmann and Governor Perry of Texas, who are now seem to be off the radar screen, but who knows? We call it the flavor of the week here. They come from very, very conservative Christian backgrounds, certainly out of the mainstream views on homosexuality. They have absolutist views on abortion. So it's a strange time, and no one, I think, can pretend to know what's coming of it. This week, Newt Gingrich, a recent convert to Catholicism, is now the front runner, but we'll see.
This is a clear attempt to court what is seen as an important religious vote, but is there in this the danger that it will backfire in that it will alienate the Catholic and Protestant mainstream Christian vote?
Well, not only the Catholic and Protestant mainstream Christian vote, and I think you're right, it will. The discussion here always is when they get past the primaries, whoever survives this gauntlet, what happens then with all of the language and all of the promises they've made and with all the pledges they've made on issues like, abortion and homosexuality, same-sex unions and all the rest of it? How do they live with the mainstream, which is far more, even in a conservative country, is far more to the left of those kinds of absolute views? And that remains to be seen. I mean, the question is this going to be, to use two elections from our history, a McGovern year or a Goldwater year, two candidates who represented the very strong ideological extremes of their parties and both lost huge. So the question is, where will this all end? Who comes out on top at the end of the process? And will they have, as you suggested, alienated themselves from mainstream and even left of the extreme evangelicals, and there are a lot more of those in this country than I think those in the extremes. Will the Tea Party begin to fade from view, or are they going to manage to hold people to convictions and promises in the primary process that they will really regret later on?
And how does the likelihood of a Romney candidacy play into this, particularly for those very, very conservative religious voters tied to a Christian fundamentalism, which, if you took it on strictly theological grounds, should place Romney outside the pale for them?
Well, we've already had the incident with one evangelical minister claiming that Romney is not a Christian, and worse. And he was quickly ushered off the stage, but the damage was done in some respects, because that view is out there and it's identified with, the Republican Party and this process and all the rest of it. I don't know. I mean, his father, George Romney, was a successful politician in the Midwest. I think he is, by every other measure, a moderate politician and businessman and all the rest of it. So that I think that religious question may fade once you get to the general election. I think the big questions for him, for Romney, in the real political sense, are not so much religious as where are you today on what issues? I mean, he has a past that really presents him a problem as a conservative.
Yes, he's been a tad liberal on some of his views.
A tad more liberal, sure. You can't be the governor of Massachusetts, one of the most liberal states in the Union, as he was, and not come away with some difficult baggage if you're running as a conservative some years later.
Now, the Obama administration faces a challenge with the bishops, too, and the health care bill, and it's been a remarkable event here, which hasn't been reported in Australia, that the bishops' opposition to some aspects of Obamacare, as it's been called, and particularly the possibility of Catholic hospitals having to undertake medical procedures which probably were against their ethical teachings, the bishops' approach on this has been undercut by, of all people, the Catholic Hospital Association and the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. Just explain to us what's going on here.
Yeah, this is a really interesting development on a whole lot of levels, and it goes well beyond healthcare. But in the brief, the bishops really oppose the Obamacare because I think of a deeply concerned offices within the bishops, you know, national structure here, who were convinced that the new law would require payment for abortions by federal money, and that's already against the law. The Catholic Health Association, led by a hospital association led by Sister Carol Keehan, and the Leadership Conference of Women and Religious came to a different conclusion. This was a real moment in Catholic history in the United States, I think, because they came out and said they were for it. So they essentially handed the administration a win here, because I don't think they could have done it without the Catholic vote in Congress. The Catholics comprise the largest number of a single denomination in both chambers of Congress. So you had this break, essentially, and some of the bishops felt really burned by it, but there was a matter of principle, and I think a new stand by women religious who are no longer just subservient. They're well educated. They run the institutions. They have to do the health care. They understand the practical problems, and they understood this legislation in a different way. The question now is, will Health and Human Services, an agency of government that actually is headed by a Catholic, Kathleen Sebelius, require that Catholic institutions, colleges, for instance, universities, hospitals, will they require that they cover certain procedures? For years, for decades, the accommodation has been Catholic health systems and Catholic hospitals, Catholic universities could claim a conscience exemption from requirements to provide, for example, contraceptive services, tubal ligations, things like that, that went against Catholic teaching. The fear here from the liberal side of things and Catholic Democrats and others is that if the Obama administration turns on the church in this one and says we can't continue those exceptions and you're going to have to provide these services, there's going to be what many think is an unnecessary confrontation that's going to destroy a lot of ill will that has been built up over the last couple of years.
Surely, Tom Roberts, in this, the Obama administration looking to its own political future would be looking towards accommodating those exceptions rather than antagonizing a possible Catholic constituency.
Well, that's the big question, and we should get an answer, you know, sometime in the next week or two. It's a delicate situation at this point, and I think that Obama is going to anger one group or another, no matter what the decision is. The question is, which constituency does he think is most important to his political future?
Yeah, and he probably figures he's got the libertarian left locked up already, and he can afford to lose a few on that side in this sort of debate. Tell me, just how much do you think Timothy Dolan is sensing the wind about the Catholic constituency itself anyway, in that you've done a survey, or the National Catholic Reporter has partnered in a survey of Catholic attitudes, which seems to reveal what most people would say anecdotally anyway, that the laity of the church is basically walking away from bishop-like pronouncements. It began with birth control, and it's continued ever since.
Yeah, and what it's showing is a loosening sort of continually of those bonds to Episcopal authority. And I think that Dolan seems to recognize that the church has got to do something different. I mean, he is the first one to publicly and several times worry about the huge flow out of the church. I mean, the numbers are staying steady because of the steady flow of, you know, Hispanics from Central America, especially in Mexico, into the United States. The baseline numbers of the church are staying pretty steady. But if you look at the fallout, 28 million ex-Catholics, according to the Pew survey, would make it the second largest after Catholics. It will remain the second largest denomination as a group in the country.
Tom Roberts, great as always to have you with us. We shall watch with interest as the politics of the United States continues to be of interest all around the world. Of course, we've just had President Obama here in all his glamour. And we shall continue to watch and talk to you about the next 12 months with interest. Tom, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.